Leak. There is a play of the 1920s called L'Abîme, The Abyss, by the well-known French author Suire. It has already passed from the stage straight into the lesser Lethe, the one that is that serves the theater, a stream incidentally not quite as hopeless as the main river and containing a weaker solution of oblivion, so that angling producers may still fish something out many years later. This play, essentially idiotic, even ideally idiotic, or, putting it another way, ideally constructed on the solid conventions of traditional dramaturgy, deals with the torments of a middle-aged, rich, and religious French lady suddenly inflamed by a sinful passion for a young Russian named Igor, who has turned up at her chateau and fallen in love with her daughter Angélique. An old friend of the family, a strong-willed, sullen bigot, conveniently knocked together by the author out of mysticism and lechery, is jealous of the heroine's interest in Igor, while she in turn is jealous of the latter's attentions to Angélique. In a word, it is all very compelling and true to life. Every speech bears the trademark of a respectable tradition, and it goes without saying that there is not a single jolt of talent to disrupt the ordered course of action, swelling where it ought to swell, and interrupted when necessary by a lyric scene or a shamelessly explanatory dialogue between two old retainers. The apple of discord is usually an elderly, sour fruit, and should be cooked. Thus the young man of the play threatens to be somewhat colorless, and it is in a vain attempt to touch him up a little that the author has made him a Russian, with all the obvious consequences of such trickery. According to Suire's optimistic intention, he is an émigré Russian aristocrat, recently adopted by an old lady, the Russian wife of a neighboring landowner. One night, at the height of a thunderstorm, Igor comes knocking at our door, enters, riding crop in hand, and announces in agitation that the pine wood is burning on his benefactress's estate, and that our pinery is also in danger. This affects us less strongly than the visitor's youthful glamour, and we are inclined to sink onto a hassock, toying pensively with our necklace, whereupon our bigot friend observes that the reflection of flames is at times more dangerous than the conflagration itself. A solid, high-quality plot, as you can see, for it is clear at once that the Russian will become a regular caller, and, in fact, Act Two is all sunny weather and bright summer clothes. Judging by the printed text of the play, Igor expresses himself, at least in the first scenes before the author tires of this, not incorrectly, but, as it were, a bit hesitantly, every so often interposing a questioning, "I think that is how you say it in French?" Later, though, when the turbulent flow of the drama leaves the author no time for such trifles, all foreign peculiarities of speech are discarded, and the young Russian spontaneously acquires the rich vocabulary of a native Frenchman. It is only toward the end, during the lull before the final burst of action, that the playwright remembers with a start the nationality of Igor, whereupon the latter casually addresses these words to the old manservant, "J'étais trop jeune pour prendre part à la, comment dit-on, Velika Voina, grande guerre." In all fairness to the author, it is true that except for this Velika Voina and one modest dosvidanya, he does not abuse his acquaintance with the Russian language, contenting himself with the stage direction. Slavic sing-song lends a certain charm to Igor's speech. In Paris, where the play had great success, Igor was played by François Coulot, and played not badly, but for some reason with a strong Italian accent, which he evidently wanted to pass off as Russian, and which did not surprise a single Parisian critic. Afterwards, when the play trickled down into the provinces, this role fell by chance to a real Russian actor, Leek, stage name of Lavrenty Ivanovich Kruzhevnitsyn, a lean, fair-haired fellow with coffee-dark eyes who had previously won some fame thanks to a film in which he did an excellent job in the bit part of a stutterer. It was hard to say, though, if Leek, the word means countenance in Russian and Middle English, possessed genuine theatrical talent or was a man of many indistinct callings who had chosen one of them at random, but could just as well have been a painter, jeweler, or rat catcher. Such a person resembles a room with a number of different doors, among which there is perhaps one that does lead straight into some great garden, into the moonlit depths of a marvelous human night, where the soul discovers the treasure intended for it alone. But be that as it may, Leek had failed to open that door, taking instead the thespian path, which he followed without enthusiasm, with the absent manner of a man looking for signposts that do not exist but that perhaps have appeared to him in a dream, or can be distinguished in the underdeveloped photograph of some other locality that he will never, never visit. On the conventional plane of earthly habitus, he was in his 30s, and so was the century. In elderly people stranded not only outside the border of their country, but outside that of their own lives, nostalgia evolves into an extraordinarily complex organ, which functions continuously, and its secretion compensates for all that has been lost, or else it becomes a fatal tumor on the soul that makes it painful to breathe, sleep, and associate with carefree foreigners. In Leek, this memory of Russia remained in the embryonic state, confined to misty childhood recollections, such as the resinous fragrance of the first spring day in the country, or the special shape of the snowflake on the wool of his hood. His parents were dead. He lived alone. There was always something sleazy about the loves and friendships that came his way. Nobody wrote gossipy letters to him. Nobody took a greater interest in his worries than he did himself. And there was no one to go and complain to about the undeserved precariousness of his very being, when he learned from two doctors, a Frenchman and a Russian, that, like many protagonists, he had an incurable heart ailment, while the streets were virtually swarming with robust oldsters. There seemed to be a certain connection between this illness of his and his fondness for fine, expensive things. He might, for example, spend his last 200 francs on a scarf or a fountain pen, but it always, always happened that the scarf would soon get soiled, the pen broken, despite the meticulous, even pious, care he took of things. In relation to the other members of the company, which he had joined as casually as a fur doffed by a woman lands on this or that quite anonymous chair, he remained as much a stranger as he had been at the first rehearsal. He had immediately had the feeling of being superfluous, of having usurped someone else's place. The director of the company was invariably friendly toward him, but Leek's hypersensitive soul constantly imagined the possibility of a row, as if at any moment he might be unmasked and accused of something unbearably shameful. The very constancy of the director's attitude he interpreted as the utmost indifference to his work, as though everyone had long since reconciled himself to its hopelessly poor quality, and he was being tolerated merely because there was no convenient pretext for his dismissal. It seemed to him, and perhaps this was actually so, that to these loud, sleek French actors, interconnected by a network of personal and professional passions, he was as much a chance object as the old bicycle that one of the characters deftly disassembled in the second act. Hence, when someone gave him a particularly hearty greeting or offered him a cigarette, he would think that there was some misunderstanding, which would, alas, be resolved in a moment. Because of his illness, he avoided drinking, but his absence from friendly gatherings, instead of being attributed to lack of sociability, leading to accusations of haughtiness and thus endowing him with at least some semblance of a personality, simply went unnoticed, as if there was no question of its being otherwise. And when they did happen to invite him somewhere, it was always in a vaguely interrogative manner. "Coming with us, or..." A manner particularly painful to one who is yearning to be persuaded to come. He understood little of the jokes, allusions, and nicknames that the others bandied about with cryptic gaiety. He almost wished some of the joking were at his expense, but even this failed to happen. At the same time, he rather liked some of his colleagues. The actor who played the bigot was, in real life, a pleasant fat fellow who had recently purchased a sports car, about which he would talk to you with genuine inspiration. And the ingenue was most charming, too, dark-haired and slender, with her splendidly bright, carefully made-up eyes, but in daytime hopelessly oblivious of her evening confessions on the stage in the garrulous embrace of her Russian fiancé, to whom she so candidly clung. Leek liked to tell himself that only on the stage did she live her true life, being subject the rest of the time to periodic fits of insanity, during which she no longer recognized him and called herself by a different name. With the leading lady he never exchanged a single word apart from their lines, and when this thick-set, tense, handsome woman walked past him in the wings, her jowl shaking, he had the feeling that he was but a piece of scenery, apt to fall flat on the floor if someone brushed against him. It is indeed difficult to say whether it was all as poor Leek imagined, or whether these perfectly harmless, self-centered people left him alone simply because he did not seek their company, and did not start a conversation with him just as passengers who have established contact among themselves do not address the foreigner absorbed in his book in a corner of the compartment. But even if Leek did attempt in rare moments of self-confidence to convince himself of the irrationality of his vague torments, the memory of similar torments was too recent, and they were too often repeated in new circumstances for him to be able to overcome them now. Loneliness as a situation can be corrected, but as a state of mind, it is an incurable illness. He played his part conscientiously, and, at least as far as accent was concerned, more successfully than his predecessor, since Leek spoke French with a Russian lilt, drawing out and softening his sentences, dropping the stress before their close, and filtering off with excessive care the spray of auxiliary expressions that so nimbly and rapidly fly off a Frenchman's tongue. His part was so small, so inconsequential, in spite of its dramatic impact on the actions of the other characters, that it was not worth pondering over. Yet he would ponder, especially at the outset of the tour, and not so much out of love for his art as because the disparity between the insignificance of the role itself and the importance of the complex drama of which he was the prime cause struck him as being a paradox that somehow humiliated him personally. However, although he soon cooled to the possibility of improvements suggested to him by both art and vanity, two things that often coincide, he would hurry on stage with unchanged mysterious delight, as though every time he anticipated some special reward, in no way connected, of course, with the customary dose of neutral applause. Neither did this reward consist in the performer's inner satisfaction. Rather, it lurked in certain extraordinary furrows and folds that he discerned in the life of the play itself, banal and hopelessly pedestrian as it was, for, like any piece acted out by live people, it gained, God knows whence, an individual soul, and attempted for a couple of hours to exist, to evolve its own heat and energy, bearing no relation to its author's pitiful conception or the mediocrity of the players, but awakening as life awakes in water warmed by sunlight. For instance, Leek might hope, one vague and lovely night in the midst of the usual performance, to tread, as it were, on a quicksandy spot. Something would give, and he would sink forever in a newborn element, unlike anything known, independently developing the play's threadbare themes in ways altogether new. He would pass irrevocably into this element, marry Angélique, go riding over the crisp heather, receive all the material wealth hinted at in the play, go to live in that castle, and moreover, find himself in a world of ineffable tenderness, a bluish, delicate world where fabulous adventures of the senses occur, and unheard-of metamorphoses of the mind. As he thought about all this, Leek imagined, for some reason, that when he died of heart failure, and he would die soon, the attack would certainly come on stage, as it had been with poor Molière, barking out his dog Latin among the doctors, but that he would not notice his death, crossing over instead into the actual world of a chance play, now blooming anew because of his arrival, while his smiling corpse lay on the boards, the toe of one foot protruding from beneath the folds of the lowered curtain. At the end of the summer, The Abyss and two other plays in the repertory were running at a Mediterranean town. Leek appeared only in The Abyss, so between the first performance and the second, only two were scheduled, he had a week of free time, which he did not quite know how to use. What is more, the southern climate did not agree with him. He went through the first performance in a blur of greenhouse delirium, with a hot drop of grease paint now hanging from the tip of his nose, now scalding his upper lip, and when, during the first intermission, he went out on the terrace separating the back of the theater from an Anglican church, he suddenly felt he would not last out the performance, but would dissolve on the stage amid many colored exhalations through which, at the final mortal instant, would flash the blissful ray of another, yes, another, life. Nevertheless, he made it to the end somehow or other, even if he did see double from the sweat in his eyes, while the smooth contact of his young partner's cool, bare arms agonizingly accentuated the melting state of his palms. He returned to his boarding house quite shattered, with aching shoulders and a reverberating pain in the back of his head. In the dark garden everything was in bloom and smelled of candy, and there was a continuous trilling of crickets, which he mistook, as all Russians do, for cicadas. His illuminated room was antiseptically white compared to the southern darkness framed in the open window. He crushed a red-bellied drunken mosquito on the wall, then sat for a long time on the edge of the bed, afraid to lie down, afraid of the palpitations. The proximity of the sea whose presence he divined beyond the lemon grove oppressed him, as if this ample, viscously glistening space, with only a membrane of moonlight stretched tight across its surface, was akin to the equally taut vessel of his drumming heart, and like it was agonizingly bare, with nothing to separate it from the sky, from the shuffling of human feet, and the unbearable pressure of the music playing in a nearby bar. He glanced at the expensive watch on his wrist, and noticed with a pang that he had lost the crystal. Yes, his cuff had brushed against a stone parapet as he had stumbled uphill a while ago. The watch was still alive, defenseless and naked, like a live organ exposed by the surgeon's knife. He passed his days in a quest for shade and a longing for coolness. There was something infernal in the glimpses of sea and beach, where bronzed demons basked on the torrid shingle. The sunny side of the narrow streets was so strictly forbidden to him that he would have had to solve intricate route-finding problems if there had been a purpose in his wanderings. He had, however, nowhere to go. He strolled aimlessly along the shop fronts, which displayed, among other objects, some rather amusing bracelets of what looked like pink amber, as well as decidedly attractive leather bookmarks and wallets tooled with gilt. He would sink into a chair beneath the orange awning of a café, then go home and lie in his bed, stark naked, dreadfully thin and white, and think about the same things he thought about incessantly. He reflected that he had been condemned to live on the outskirts of life, that it had always been thus, and always would be, and that, therefore, if death did not present him with an exit into true reality, he would simply never come to know life. He also reflected that, if his parents were alive instead of having died at the dawn of emigre existence, the 15 years of his adult life might have passed in the warmth of a family, that had his destiny been less mobile, he would have finished one of the 3 gymnasiums he had happened to attend at random points of middle, median, mediocre Europe, and would now have a good, solid job among good, solid people. But, strain his imagination as he might, he could not picture either that job or those people, just as he could not explain to himself why he had studied as a youth at a screen acting school, instead of taking up music or numismatics, window washing or bookkeeping. And, as always, from each point of its circumference his thought would follow a radius back to the dark center, to the presentiment of nearing death, for which he, who had accumulated no spiritual treasures, was hardly an interesting prey. Nonetheless, she had apparently determined to give him precedence. One evening, as he was reclining in a canvas chair on the veranda, he was importuned by one of the pension guests, a loquacious old Russian, who had managed on 2 occasions already to recount to Leek the story of his life, first in one direction, from the present toward the past, and then in the other, against the grain, resulting in two different lives, one successful, the other not, who, settling himself comfortably and fingering his chin, said, "A friend of mine has turned up here. That is, a friend, c'est beaucoup dire. I met him a couple of times in Brussels, that's all. Now, alas, he's a completely derelict character. Yesterday, yes, I think it was yesterday, I happened to mention your name, and he says, 'Why, of course I know him. In fact, we're even relatives.'" "Relatives?" asked Leek with surprise. "I almost never had any relatives. What's his name?" "A certain Koldunov. Oleg Petrovich Koldunov. Petrovich, isn't it? Know him?" "It just can't be!" cried Leek, covering his face with his hands. "Yes, imagine," said the other. "It can't be," repeated Leek. "You see, I always thought..." "This is awful. You didn't give him my address, did you?" "I did. I understand, though. One feels disgusted and sorry at the same time. Kicked out of everywhere, embittered, has a family, and so on. Listen, do me a favor. Can't you tell him I've left? If I see him, I'll tell him, but... well, I just happened to run into him down at the port. My, what lovely yachts they have down there. That's what I call fortunate people. You live on the water and sail wherever you feel like. Champagne, girlies, everything all polished." And the old fellow smacked his lips and shook his head. What a mad thing to happen, Leek thought all evening. What a mess! He did not know what had given him the idea that Oleg Koldunov was no longer among the living. It was one of those axioms that the rational mind no longer keeps on active duty, relegating it to the remotest depths of consciousness, so that now, with Koldunov's resurrection, he had to admit the possibility of two parallel lines crossing after all. Yet it was agonizingly difficult to get rid of the old concept, embedded in his brain, as if the extraction of this single false notion might vitiate the entire order of his other notions and concepts. And now he simply could not recall what data had led him to conclude that Koldunov had perished, and why, in the past 20 years, there had been such a strengthening in the chain of dim initial information out of which Koldunov's doom had been wrought. Their mothers had been cousins. Oleg Koldunov was 2 years his elder. For 4 years they had gone to the same provincial gymnasium, and the memory of those years had always been so hateful to Leek that he preferred not to recall his boyhood. Indeed, his Russia was perhaps so thickly clouded over for the very reason that he did not cherish any personal recollections. Dreams, however, would still occur, even now, for there was no control over them. Sometimes Koldunov would appear in person, in his own image, in the surroundings of boyhood, hastily assembled by the director of dreams out of such accessories as a classroom, desks, a blackboard, and its dry, weightless sponge. Besides these down-to-earth dreams, there were also romantic, even decadent ones, devoid, that is, of Koldunov's obvious presence, but coded by him, saturated with his oppressive spirit or filled with rumors about him, with situations and shadows of situations somehow expressing his essence. And this excruciating Koldunovian decor, against which the action of a chance dream would develop, was far worse than the straightforward dream visitations of Koldunov as Leek remembered him, a coarse, muscular high school boy, with cropped hair and a disagreeably handsome face. The regularity of his strong features was spoiled by eyes that were set too close together and equipped with heavy, leathery lids. No wonder they had dubbed him the crocodile, for indeed there was a certain turbid, muddy Nile quality in his glance. Koldunov had been a hopelessly poor student. His was that peculiarly Russian hopelessness of the seemingly bewitched dunce as he sinks in a vertical position through the transparent strata of several repeated classes, so that the youngest boys gradually reach his level, numb with fear, and then a year later leave him behind with relief. Koldunov was remarkable for his insolence, uncleanliness, and savage physical strength. After one had a tussle with him, the room would always reek of the menagerie. Leek, on the other hand, was a frail, sensitive, vulnerably proud boy, and therefore represented an ideal, inexhaustible prey. Koldunov would come flowing over him wordlessly and industriously torture the squash but always squirming victim on the floor. Koldunov's enormous, splayed palm would go into an obscene scooping motion as it penetrated the convulsive, panic-stricken depths it sought. Thereupon he would leave Leek, whose back was covered with chalk dust and whose tormented ears were aflame, in peace for an hour or two, content to repeat some obscenely meaningless phrase insulting to Leek. Then, when the urge returned, Koldunov would sigh almost reluctantly before piling on him again, digging his horn-like nails into Leek's ribs or sitting down for a rest on the victim's face. He had a thorough knowledge of all the bully's devices for causing the sharpest pain without leaving marks, and therefore enjoyed the servile respect of his schoolmates. At the same time, he nurtured a vaguely sentimental affection for his habitual patient, making a point of strolling with his arm around the other's shoulders during the class breaks, his heavy, distray paw palpating the thin collarbone, while Leek tried in vain to preserve an air of independence and dignity. Thus, Leek's school days were an utterly absurd and unbearable torment. He was embarrassed to complain to anyone, and his nighttime thoughts of how he would finally kill Koldunov merely drained his spirit of all strength. Fortunately, they almost never met outside of school, although Leek's mother would have liked to establish closer ties with her cousin, who was much richer than she and kept her own horses. Then the revolution began rearranging the furniture, and Leek found himself in a different city, while 15-year-old Oleg, already sporting a mustache and completely brutified, disappeared in the general confusion, and a blissful lull began. It was soon replaced, however, by new, more subtle tortures at the hands of the initial rackmaster's minor successors. Sad to say, on the rare occasions when Leek spoke of his past, he would publicly recall the presumed deceased with that artificial smile with which we reward a distant time. Those were the happy days. It sleeps with a full belly in a corner of its evil-smelling cage. Now, however, when Koldunov proved to be alive, no matter what adult arguments Leek invoked, he could not conquer the same sensation of helplessness, metamorphosed by reality, but all the more manifest, that oppressed him in dreams when, from behind a curtain, smirking, fiddling with his belt buckle, stepped the lord of the dream, a dark, dreadful schoolboy. And, even though Leek understood perfectly well that the real, live Koldunov would not harm him now, the possibility of meeting him seemed ominous, fateful, dimly linked to the whole system of evil, with its premonitions of torment and abuse so familiar to him. After his conversation with the old man, Leek decided to stay at home as little as possible. Only 3 days remained before the last performance, so it was not worth the trouble to move to a different boarding house, but he could, for instance, take day-long trips across the Italian border or into the mountains, since the weather had grown much cooler, with a drizzling rain and a brisk wind. Early next morning, walking along a narrow path between flower-hung walls, he saw coming toward him a short, husky man whose dress in itself differed little from the usual uniform of the Mediterranean vacationer, beret, open-necked shirt, espadrilles, but somehow suggested not so much the license of the season as the compulsion of poverty. In the first instant, Leek was struck most of all by the fact that the monstrous figure that filled his memory with its bulk proved to be, in reality, hardly taller than himself.
"Lavrenti! Lavrusha! Don't you recognize me?"
Koldunov drawled dramatically, stopping in the middle of the path. The large features of that sallow face with a rough shadow on its cheeks and upper lip, that glimpse of bad teeth, that large, insolent Roman nose, that bleary, questioning gaze, all of it was Koldunovian, indisputably so, even if dimmed by time. But as Leek looked, this resemblance noiselessly disintegrated, and before him stood a disreputable stranger with the massive face of a Caesar, though a very shabby one.
"Let's kiss like good Russians," Koldunov said grimly,
and pressed his cold, salty cheek for an instant against Leek's childish lips. "I recognized you immediately," babbled Leek. "Just yesterday I heard about you from, what's his name? Gavrilyuk."
"Dubious character," interrupted Koldunov. "Méfie-toi."
"Well, well, so here is my Lavrusha. Remarkable. I'm glad. Glad to meet you again. That's fate for you. Remember, Lavrusha, how we used to catch gobies together? As clear as if it happened yesterday. One of my fondest memories, yes."
Leek knew perfectly well that he had never fished with Koldunov, but confusion, ennui, and timidity prevented him from accusing this stranger of appropriating a non-existent past. He suddenly felt wiggly and overdressed.
"How many times," continued Koldunov, examining with interest Leek's pale gray trousers, "how many times during the past years, oh, yes, I thought of you. Yes, indeed. And where, thought I, is my Lavrusha? I've told my wife about you. She was once a pretty woman. And what line of work are you in?"
"I'm an actor," sighed Leek.
"Allow me an indiscretion," said Koldunov in a confidential tone. "I'm told that in the United States there is a secret society that considers the word money improper, and if payment must be made, they wrap the dollars in toilet paper. True, only the rich belong, the poor have no time for it. Now here's what I'm driving at."
And his brows raised questioningly, Koldunov made a vulgar palpating motion with two fingers and thumb. The feel of hard cash.
"Alas, no," Leek exclaimed innocently. "Most of the year I'm unemployed, and the pay is miserable."
"I know how sad it is, and understand perfectly," said Koldunov with a smile. In any case, there's a project I'd like to discuss with you sometime. You could make a nice little profit. Are you doing anything right now?"
"Well, you see, as a matter of fact, I'm going to Bordighera for the whole day by bus, and tomorrow..."
"What a shame! If you had told me. There's a Russian chauffeur I know here, with a smart private car, and I would have shown you the whole Riviera, you ninny.
All right, I'll walk you to the bus stop." "And anyway, I'm leaving for good soon," Leek put in.
"Tell me, how's the family? How's Aunt Natasha?"
Koldunov asked absently as they walked along a crowded little street that led down to the seafront.
"I see. I see,"
he nodded at Leek's reply. Suddenly a guilty, demented look passed fleetingly across his evil face.
"Listen, Lavrusha,"
he said, pushing him involuntarily and bringing his face close to Leek's on the narrow sidewalk.
"Meeting you is an omen for me. It is a sign that all is not lost yet. And I must admit that just the other day I was thinking that all was lost. Do you understand what I am saying?"
"Oh, everybody has such thoughts now and then," said Leek.
They reached the promenade. The sea was opaque and corrugated under the overcast sky, and here and there near the parapet the foam had splashed onto the pavement. There was no one about except for a solitary lady in slacks sitting on a bench with an open book in her lap.
"Here, give me 5 francs and I'll buy you some cigarettes for the trip,"
Koldunov said rapidly. Taking the money, he added in a different, easy tone,
"Look, that's the little wife over there. Keep her company for a minute and I'll be right back."
Leek went up to the blonde lady and said with an actor's automatism, "Your husband will be right back," and forgot to introduce me. "I am a cousin of his." At the same moment he was sprinkled by the cool dust of a breaker. The lady looked up at Leek with blue English eyes, unhurriedly closed her red book, and left without a word.
"Just a joke," said Koldunov as he reappeared out of breath. "Voila! I'll take a few for myself. Yes, I'm afraid my little woman has no time to sit on a bench and look at the sea. I implore you, promise me that we'll meet again. Remember the omen. Tomorrow, after tomorrow, whenever you want. Promise me. Wait, I'll give you my address.
He took Leek's brand new gilt and leather notebook, sat down, bent forward his sweaty, swollen-veined forehead, joined his knees, and not only wrote his address, reading it over with agonizing care, redotting an I and underlining a word, but also sketched a street map. So, so, then so. Evidently he had done this more than once, and more than once people had stood him up, using the forgotten address as an excuse. Hence he wrote with great diligence and force, a force that was almost incantational. The bus arrived.
So I'll expect you, shouted Koldenov, helping Leek aboard.
Then he turned, full of energy and hope, and walked resolutely off along the promenade as if he had some pressing, important business, though it was perfectly obvious that he was an idler, a drunkard, and a bore. The following day, a Wednesday, Leek took a trip to the mountains and then spent the greater part of Thursday lying in his room with a bad headache. The performance was that evening, the departure tomorrow. At about 6 p.m, he went out to pick up his watch at the jeweler's and buy some nice white shoes, an innovation he had long wanted to sport in the second act. Separating the bead curtain, he emerged from the shop, shoebox under arm, and ran straight into Koldenov. Koldenov's greeting lacked the former ardor, and had a slightly derisive note instead.
"Oh-ho! You won't wriggle out of it this time," he said, taking Leek firmly by the elbow. "Come on, let's go. You'll see how I live and work."
"I have a performance tonight," Leek objected, "and I'm leaving tomorrow."
"That's just the point, my friend, that's just the point. Seize the opportunity. Take advantage of it. There will never be another chance. The card is trumped. Come on, get going."
Repeating disconnected words and imitating with all his unattractive being the senseless joy of a man who has reached the borderline and perhaps even gone beyond it, a poor imitation, Leek thought vaguely, Koldenov walked briskly, prodding on his weak companion. The entire company of actors was sitting on the terrace of a corner cafe and, noticing Leek, greeted him with a peripatetic smile that really did not belong to any one member of the group, but skittered across the lips of each like an independent spot of reflected sunlight. Koldenov led Leek up a crooked little street, mottled here and there by jaundiced crooked sunlight. Leek had never visited this squalid old quarter. The tall, bare facades of the narrow houses seemed to lean over the pavement from either side, with their tops almost meeting. Sometimes they coalesced completely, forming an arch. Repulsive infants were puttering about by the doorways. Black, foul-smelling water ran down the sidewalk gutter. Suddenly changing direction, Koldenov shoved him into a shop and, flaunting the cheapest French slang, in the manner of many Russian paupers, bought 2 bottles of wine with Leek's money. It was evident that he was long since in debt here, and now there was a desperate glee in his whole bearing and in his menacing exclamations of greeting, which brought no response whatever from either the shopkeeper or the shopkeeper's mother-in-law, and this made Leek even more uncomfortable. They walked on, turning into an alley, and although it had seemed that the vile street they had just ascended represented the utmost limit of squalor, filth, and congestion, this passage, with limp wash hanging overhead, managed to embody an even greater dejection. At the corner of a lopsided little square, Koldenov said that he would go in first, and, leaving Leek, headed for the black cavity of an open door. Simultaneously, a fair-haired little boy came dashing out of it, but, seeing the advancing, Koldenov ran back, brushing against a pail which reacted with a harsh clink.
"Wait, Vasyuk!" shouted Koldenov, and lumbered into his murky abode.
As soon as he entered, a frenzied female voice issued from within, yelling something in what seemed a habitually overwrought tone. But then the scream ceased abruptly, and a minute later Koldenov peeped out and grimly beckoned to Leek. Leek crossed the threshold and immediately found himself in a low-ceilinged dark room, whose bare walls, as if distorted by some awful pressure from above, formed incomprehensible curves and corners. The place was crammed with the dingy stage properties of indigence. The boy of a moment ago sat on the sagging connubial bed. A huge, fair-haired woman with thick bare feet emerged from a corner, and without a smile on her bloated pale face, whose every feature, even the eyes, seemed smudged by fatigue or melancholy or God knows what, wordlessly greeted Leek.
"Get acquainted, get acquainted," Koldenov muttered in derisive encouragement, and immediately set about uncorking the wine.
His wife put some bread and a plate of tomatoes on the table. She was so silent that Leek began to doubt whether it had been this woman who had screamed a moment ago. She sat down on a bench in the back of the room, busying herself with something, cleaning something, with a knife over a spread newspaper, it seemed. Leek was afraid to look too closely, while the boy, his eyes glistening, moved over to the wall and, maneuvering cautiously, slipped out into the street. There was a multitude of flies in the room, and with maniacal persistence they haunted the table and settled on Leek's forehead.
"All right, let's have a drink," said Koldenov.
"I can't. I'm not allowed to," Leek was about to object, but instead, obeying the oppressive influence he knew well from his nightmares, he took a swallow and went into a fit of coughing.
"That's better," said Koldenov with a sigh, wiping his trembling lips with the back of his hand. "You see," he continued, filling Leek's glass and his own, "here's the situation. This is going to be a business talk. Allow me to tell you in brief. At the beginning of summer, I worked for a month or so with some other Russians here, collecting beach garbage. But as you well know, I am an outspoken man who likes the truth. And when a scoundrel turns up, I come right out and say, 'You're a scoundrel,' and if necessary, I punch him in the mouth. Well, one day," and Koldenov began telling, circumstantially, with painstaking repetitions, a dull, wretched episode, and one had the feeling that for a long time his life had consisted of such episodes, that humiliation and failure, heavy cycles of ignoble idleness and ignoble toil, culminating in the inevitable row, had long since become a profession with him. Leek, meanwhile, began to feel drunk after the first glass, but nevertheless went on sipping with concealed revulsion. A kind of tickling fog permeated every part of his body, but he dared not stop, as if his refusal of wine would lead to a shameful punishment. Leaning on one elbow, Koldenov talked uninterruptedly, stroking the edge of the table with one hand and occasionally slapping it to stress some particularly somber word. His head, the color of yellowish clay, he was almost completely bald, the bags under his eyes, the enigmatically malignant expression of his mobile nostrils, all of this had completely lost any connection with the image of the strong, handsome schoolboy who used to torment Leek. But the coefficient of nightmare remained unchanged. "There you are, friend. This is no longer important," said Koldenov in a different, less narrative tone. "Actually, I had this little tale all ready for you last time when it occurred to me that fate, I'm an old fatalist, had given a certain meaning to our meeting, that you had come as a savior, so to speak. But now it turns out that, in the first place, you, forgive me, are as stingy as a Jew. And in the second place, who knows, maybe you really are not in a position to make me a loan. Have no fear, have no fear. This topic is closed. Moreover, it would have only been a question of a small sum to get me back, not on my feet, that would be a luxury, but merely on all fours, because I'm sick of sprawling with my face in the muck. I'm not going to ask anything of you. It's not my style to beg. All I want is your opinion about something. It's merely a philosophical question. Ladies need not listen. How do you explain all this? You see, if a definite explanation exists, then fine. I'm willing to put up with the muck, since that means there is something logical and justified in all this. Perhaps something useful to me or to others, I don't know. Here, explain this to me. I am a human being. You certainly cannot deny that, can you? All right. I am a human being, and the same blood runs in my veins as in yours. Believe it or not, I was my late mama's only and beloved. As a boy, I played pranks. As a youth, I went to war, and the ball started rolling. God, how it rolled. What went wrong? No, you tell me what went wrong. I just want to know what went wrong, then I'll be satisfied. Why has life systematically baited me? Why have I been assigned the part of some kind of miserable scoundrel who is spat on by everybody, gypped, bullied, thrown into jail? Here's an example for you. When they were taking me away after a certain incident in Lyon, and I might add that I was absolutely in the right, and am now very sorry I did not finish him off. Well, as the police were taking me away, ignoring my protests, you know what they did? They stuck a little hook right here in the live flesh of my neck. What kind of treatment is that, I ask you? And off the cop led me to the police station, and I floated along like a sleepwalker, because every additional motion made me black out with pain. Well, can you explain why they don't do this to other people, and then, all of a sudden, do it to me? Why did my first wife run away with a Circassian? Why did 7 people nearly beat me to death in Antwerp in 32 in a small room? And look at all this. What's the reason for it? These rags, these walls, that Katya over there. The story of my life interests me, and has so for a long while. This isn't any Jack London or Dostoevsky story for you. I live in a corrupt country, all right? I am willing to put up with the French, all right, but we must find some explanation, gentlemen. I was talking with a guy once, and he asks me, why don't you go back to Russia? Why not, after all? The difference is very small. There they'd persecute me just the same, knock my teeth in, stick me in the cooler, and then invite me to be shot. And at least that would be honest. You see, I'm even willing to respect them. God knows they are honest murderers. Well, here these crooks will think up such tortures for you, it's almost enough to make you feel nostalgic for the good old Russian bullet. Hey, why aren't you looking at me? You, or don't you understand what I'm saying? No, I understand everything, said Leek. Only please excuse me, I don't feel well. I must be going. I have to be at the theater soon. Oh, no. Wait just a minute. I understand a few things myself. You're a strange fellow. Come on, make me an offer of some kind. Try. Maybe you'll shower me with gold after all, eh? Listen, you know what? I'll sell you a gun. It'll be very useful to you on the stage. Bang, and down goes the hero. It's not even worth 100 francs, but I need more than 100. I'll let you have it for 1,000. Want it? No, I don't, said Leek listlessly. And I really have no money. I've been through it all myself, the hunger and so forth. No, I won't have any more. I feel sick. You keep drinking, you son of a bitch, and you won't feel sick. All right, forget it. I just did it to see what you'd say. I won't be bought anyway. Only please answer my question. Who was it decided I should suffer, and then condemn my child to the same lousy Russian fate? Just a minute, though. Suppose I, too, want to sit down in my dressing gown and listen to the radio. What went wrong, eh? Take you, for instance. What makes you better than me? You go swaggering around, living in hotels, smooching with actresses. What's the reason for it? Come on, explain it to me. Leek said, I turned out to have, I happen to have, though I don't know, a modest dramatic talent, I suppose you could say. Talent? Shouted Koldunov. I'll show you talent. I'll show you such talent that you'll start cooking applesauce in your pants. You're a dirty rat, chum. That's your only talent. I must say, that's a good one.
Koldunov started shaking in very primitive mimicry of side-splitting laughter.
So, according to you, I'm the lowest, filthiest vermin, and deserve my rotten end? Splendid. Simply splendid. Everything is explained. Eureka! Eureka! The card is trumped. The nail is in. The beast is butchered.
Oleg Petrovich is upset. Maybe you ought to be going now,
Koldunov's wife suddenly said from her corner, with a strong Estonian accent. There was not the least trace of emotion in her voice, causing her remark to sound wooden and senseless. Koldunov slowly turned in his chair, without altering the position of his hand, which lay as if lifeless on the table, and fixed his wife with an enraptured gaze.
I am not detaining anyone, he spoke softly and cheerfully. And I'll be thankful not to be detained by others, or told what to do. So long, mister, he added, not looking at Leek, who for some reason found it necessary to say, I'll write from Paris, without fail.
So he's going to write, is he?
Said Koldunov softly, apparently still addressing his wife. With some trouble, Leek extricated himself from the chair and started in her direction, but swerved and bumped into the bed.
Go away. It's all right,
she said calmly, and then, with a polite smile, Leek stumbled out of the house. His first sensation was one of relief. He had escaped from the orbit of that drunken, moralizing moron. Then came a mounting horror. He was sick to his stomach, and his arms and legs belonged to different people. How was he to perform that night? The worst of all, though, was that his whole body, which seemed to consist of ripples and dots, sensed the approach of a heart attack. It was as if an invisible stake were pointing at him, and he might impale himself any moment. This was why he must follow a weaving course, even stopping and backing slightly now and then. Nevertheless, his mind remained rather lucid. He knew that only 36 minutes remained before the start of the performance, and he knew the way home. It would be a better idea, though, to go down to the embankment, to sit by the sea until he felt better. This will pass. This will pass. If only I don't die. He also grasped the fact that the sun had just set, that the sky was already more luminous and more tender than the earth. What unnecessary, offensive nonsense! He walked, calculating every step, but sometimes he would err and passers-by would turn to look at him. Happily, he did not encounter many of them, since it was the hallowed dinner hour, and when he reached the seafront he found it quite deserted. The lights burned on the pier, casting long reflections on the tinted water, and these bright dots and inverted exclamation marks seemed to be shining translucently in his own head. He sat down on a bench, hurting his coccyx as he did so, and shut his eyes. But then everything began to spin. His heart was reflected as a terrifying globe on the dark inner side of his eyelids. It continued to swell agonizingly. And to put a stop to this, he opened his eyes and tried to hook his gaze on things, on the evening star, on that black buoy in the sea, on a darkened eucalyptus tree at the end of the promenade. I know all this, he thought. I understand all this, and, in the twilight, the eucalyptus strangely resembles a big Russian birch. Can this be the end? Such an idiotic end. I feel worse and worse. What's happening to me? Oh, my God. About 10 minutes passed. No more. His watch ticked on, trying tactfully not to look at him. The thought of death coincided precisely with the thought that in half an hour he would walk out onto the bright stage and say the first words of his part,
Je vous prie d'excuser, madame, cette invasion nocturne.
And these words, clearly and elegantly engraved in his memory, seemed far more real than the lapping and splashing of the weary waves, or the sound of two gay female voices coming from behind the stone wall of a nearby villa, or the recent talk of Koldunov, or even the pounding of his own heart. His feeling of sickness suddenly reached such a panicky pitch that he got up and walked along the parapet, dazedly stroking it and peering at the colored inks of the evening sea.
"In any case," Leek said aloud, "I have to cool off. Instant cure. Either I'll die, or it'll help."
He slid down the sloping edge of the sidewalk where the parapet stopped and crunched across the pebbly beach. There was nobody on the shore, except for a shabbily dressed man who happened to be lying supine near a boulder, his feet spread wide apart. Something about the outline of his legs and shoulders for some reason reminded Leek of Koldunov. Swaying a little and already stooping, Leek walked self-consciously to the edge of the water, and was about to scoop some up in his hands and douse his head, but the water was alive, moving, and threatening to soak his feet. "Perhaps I have enough coordination left to take off my shoes and socks," he thought, and in the same instant remembered the carton box containing his new shoes. He had forgotten it at Koldunov's. And as soon as he remembered it, this image proved so stimulating that immediately everything was simplified. And this saved Leek in the same way as a situation is sometimes saved by its rational formulation. He must get those shoes at once. There was just time enough to get them, and as soon as this was accomplished, he would step on stage in them. All perfectly clear and logical. Forgetting the pressure in his chest, the foggy feeling, the nausea, Leek climbed back up to the promenade and in a sonorously recorded voice hailed the empty taxi that was just leaving the curb by the villa across the way. Its brakes responded with a lacerating moan. He gave the chauffeur the address from his notebook, telling him to go as fast as possible, even though the entire trip, there and from there to the theater, would not take more than 5 minutes. The taxi approached Koldunov's place from the direction of the square. A crowd had gathered, and it was only by dint of persistent threats with its horn that the driver managed to squeeze through. Koldunov's wife was sitting on a chair by the public fountain. Her forehead and left cheek glistened with blood. Her hair was matted, and she sat quite straight and motionless, surrounded by the curious, while next to her, also motionless, stood her boy, in a blood-stained shirt, covering his face with his fist. A kind of tableau. A policeman, mistaking Leek for a doctor, escorted him into the room. The dead man lay on the floor amid broken crockery, his face blasted by a gunshot in the mouth, his widespread feet in new, white... "Those are mine," said Leek in French.